King Bird, fucking bird. You're watching your napkin bird.
So, aside from burning shit, there's the obvious question of why do magic? Now, I don't think there's anyone who's been to all three intensives. You were at the second one. Well, yes, I have and Chris has. You were at the first one. I think most of you, this is the first one that any of you have been to. And in the first two, the first one had kind of one version of sort of like a class on like kind of cosmology and how magic works and how the universe is set up. And it was kind of a little bit basic, like less basic than most other classes and all, but still basic in my view. And we ran through the Kabbalion and talked about the idea of the universe being set up based on a series of laws, and that you understand those laws and learn to apply them. Kind of like kinematics, but for magic. The second class was actually more straight-up physics-oriented, because we went through relativity and certain elements of... we talked about quantum mechanics, too? Or is it mostly just relativity and the gravitational field?
It's happened before. I don't know if it was in that class,
okay.
But it's happened before.
So it was a lot of like hardcore cosmological physics... for the cosmology class last time. This time there's not really a straight-up cosmology class, more of a history lesson, and the history of why magic is awesome. But and this kind of the idea for this one came from one of the 101 classes that we did once. And it was probably James and John that were there for the right. Yes, Mo might have been there too. Where I forget what it was I was supposed to be talking about, but ended up talking about, I think it was history of magic, but it ended up being this whole thing where it was like sort of, this is what all these magical systems were about before, and this is what people do now, and we lost something, but it's really still there, you just have to go get it. And it was actually one of my favorite classes that I've ever taught, but I didn't record it, and so it's gone forever. Yes, and this one will not be as awesome as that one, I promise. But I also have a Snuggie, which I actually brought with you in
mind. Don't make me use the Snuggie, that's just mean.
You could use it as a blanket instead of a backwards robe, which is... So...
Like calendar girls, magicians, and Snuggies.
When a robe isn't enough.
We have enough hot chicks in the OTO, we could do that.
We have a lot of hot chicks in the OTO. We have a decent number of hot men, too.
That's true.
So... Hot chicks and hot men aside, why do we do magic? And it is fun. There's a group of magicians. Yes, because I'm angry. It's like 90% of my life. But Nick actually, in his kind of introducing himself part, kind of hit on kind of what the main reason I think people do magic is, and it's to better your life. Victor Anderson, who was he started the Anderson fairy tradition and was Starhawk's teacher before she went like nutty uber feminist political crazy. He used to say that there would always be witchcraft so long as there was suffering,
mm-hmm.
because people seek out magic in order to alleviate what they feel is wrong in their lives. It's the same thing for any other religion. C.S. Lewis said that all of the pain and suffering, all the wars, all of the horrible things that people do are because people try to find things aside from God to fill the void in their lives. Both statements are the same idea, that there is some void, there's some absence that people experience, because people by design are meant to be united with the rest of the universe and part of that single continuum of everything. But in your experience, you're individual and you think that you're cut off from that continuum and don't feel what it's like to be part of it. You don't remember being part of it, just like a baby doesn't remember being inside their mother's womb. But that doesn't mean that the baby wasn't inside their womb, the mother's womb, and that doesn't mean that you weren't originally and aren't still are a part of the rest of God. but for the moment, your experience is that you're separate from the rest of God.
You babies clearly remember being inside the womb. That's why they're crying. You're like, put me back in the warm in there, bitches.
That's why men are always trying to get back inside.
That was the perfect setup, Stephanie.
I have to say, I did not come up with that joke. So, the... Yes. you're trying to alleviate that suffering of separation, and that suffering from separation is at the core of every other suffering you experience in your life, which is, I guess, kind of a less bleak version of the idea of Buddhism. There, I guess, you're suffering because you're dependent on everything else, and you shouldn't be. Here it's more, well, yes, you should be dependent on something. You just need to be dependent on that permanent thing instead of all these other fake things. And so magic is a way of finding the answers to the questions of life, all those things where you're like, why are we here? Or why is this happening the way it is? And understanding how the universe is structured, how you're structured, how God is structured, so you can come back to uniting yourself and the universe and God all into one continual piece. And in doing that, not only do you alleviate your own suffering, but you find ways to better the general experience of your life while you're experiencing it as an individual by learning how to change things and make things more amenable to yourself. Whereas James's son wants things to be, learning to materialize things. Or, you know, you're not going to learn that yet. No, no. You could. So you also learn to benefit the lives of others. We're going to talk a little bit later about Rosicrucianism, and the whole core of Rosicrucianism was that you were supposed to be going out and bettering the lives of other people. The Rosicrucians' main imperative was to go out and heal others. And what you'll find, the more that you're around magic and studying magic, you'll see a lot of people talk about healing is like the main thing they focus on in magic. And in the modern era, that has become very straight up, just going out and like, oh, we should learn to heal sick people. But in a more classical sense, when they talked about healing things, it was correcting the imbalances and correcting those things that were incorrect in life, making things whole again. And the processes of actually healing someone that's ill and the process of just fixing things that are wrong are essentially the same processes in a magical sense. And so as you begin learning magic, you understand that that's part of what it is that you're doing, is you're engaging in what the Jews call tikkunin, or the reparations, where you are finding those things that are not the way that they're supposed to be and not amenable to human life and the human experience, and helping to make them better. So then there's the obvious question, if you're like, okay, well, yeah, this magic stuff, all right, I want to go out, I want to help people, I want to make my life better, I want to find the answer to that gaping hole in my soul.
It's not that big.
Mine is huge.
And then you do the goatsy.
The next obvious question that someone would ask is actually the question Dustin asked me the other night. Is this a rational pursuit? Do rational, sane people do this? And the answer is no. No. Yeah.
No.
Huh, yeah, that's a good question. I think just about everything you look at on TV proves that the answer is no. There are none. But to entertain that question, if you really look at people around you, more people believe in magic than let on. I used to love it in school. I went to a Catholic high school and was pretty open about the fact that I was involved in magic and was like our key central magical figure in my school. And so often I would get all of the little Catholic kids coming up to me and being like, I want this, but I don't want to ask God for it, so I'm going to ask you for it instead. And I was like, you do realize you're praying to me now, right? They're like, no, you're a witch, you're a magician, you do things, and I want you to do something for me. I'm just... Yes. I'm the one you go to for all your bad desires. It's more approachable. Yes. Well, we proved there are lots of alternatives. All these people who, like, if you were to just say to them, like, hey, do you believe in magic? They'd be like, no, that's silly. And then it's like, oh, there's somebody who does magic. I want to get laid. Let me go ask the magician to help me.
Anybody who talks to the car, oh, come on, baby. Just please start. I swear that I'll take the mechanic next week.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or the computer.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Everybody who does that, whether they like it or not.
And you'll... And I think you'd also find, aside from the fact that people like go about and do kind of magical things or ask magical people for help, that up until recently, I think now people are a little bit more like cut off and divorced from things. And like if you look at little kids, it's like all the stuff that you learned in school about like nature and the seasons and like just like general getting along in community. It's like kids don't learn that anymore in school. Like. Mm. It's like all the folksy things that were part of life are like dying, and but when that stuff was still a part of like normal everyday life, I think a lot more people had a lot more magic things that they did, and so I mean I think even like most people that are adults now still have like a lot of little magic things that they do without recognizing it. I just kind of wonder with like the people that are kids now whether or not they're gonna have that. Yes. I think the other thing is there's so much straight up magic out there. Maybe they'll just all grow up and learn that too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. And so yeah, I guess with that they don't need other magic. But there was an episode of I can't remember if it was Twilight Zone or Outer Limits or Night Gallery or one of those shows where this board of directors of a company wanted to oust like one of their big important guys because they found out that he was a warlock and he was like helping the company by practicing magic in like the secret chamber behind his office in their facility. And so at the board meeting where they're all ready to vote him out for his magic, he goes around the room and he points out the magical things that each of them do. Mm-hmm. And they were all pretty basic things, from like checking the horoscope to carrying good luck charms to like all the little like superstitions that people do in their lives because they really believe that it's actually going to affect their lives. And now whether or not all those superstitions are rational or not, it does show that it is an ingrained normal part of human thinking and human behavior. Mm-hmm. to have these views. And a step beyond that, I think another thing you can look at is that, again, up until recently, almost all of your major thinkers and developers of society and science were also magicians. Mm-hmm. One of the most famous examples, at least in kind of the academia of magic, is Judah the Pious, who was in amongst regular magicians, no one's going to know who he is, but he's really big in Judaism. He was an Ashkenazic Jew back during the time when Ashkenazic mysticism was really going, before Kabbalah started, and he wrote one of the most important like Jewish legalism texts, like analyzing the Talmud and talking about how Jewish legalism worked. And he was considered one of the champions of Jewish rationalism. And there was often like this debate in like the development of academic study of Jewish mysticism of like the rationalists versus the mystics, and how they were like two different movements in exploring Jewish spirituality. And Judah the Pious is a really good example of how that wasn't actually historically true, because he also wrote some of the most important mystical texts of the time. And when those were first discovered to have been written by him, there were a lot of people who were like, no, someone who was that rational could never have written these things. And then they went through and they looked at a lot of things in the writing style and showed, like, okay, it's pretty strong that this is probably written by him. But then I think they actually also found, like, documentation from when he was alive where it was like, yes, he did write these. Like, either, like, letters between him and other people about them or, like, journal entries or something like that. So there's really no question that he wrote both these very rationalistic things and these very mystical things. My favorite example is Isaac Newton. In fact, like, someday I want to have, like, an alchemy awareness organization that goes around to schools and teaches them about all the famous alchemists, and it'd be like the Isaac Newton Foundation or something like that. But, I mean, Newton is, like, the great granddaddy of modern science, and he, like, invented kinematics. Like, you can't get more rational and scientific and intelligent than Isaac Newton. And he spent more of his time writing about spiritual and occult doctrines and practices than he did about science. There's actually an organization that has a lot of his journals and a lot of his unpublished writings online now to download for free. And the vast majority of them are cosmological writings based on his spiritual ideas and his alchemical work. Because he spent more time engaged in alchemy than he did engaged in scientific research, to the point where they almost fired him from his university position. If you look at John Trithemius, he had at one point the greatest library in all of Europe. He was one of the most important abbots in Europe. Kings and popes went to him when they wanted information or education about things. He was also the teacher of at least two of the most important figures in magical history, Paracelsus and Cornelius Agrippa. And he wrote magical texts that are a little bit more obscure now, but are still important magical texts, and probably were some of the most influential works to influence John Dee. John Dee is another great example, because he was, in addition to being awesome and being the first British spy to ever use 007 as his moniker, he helped invent Greenwich Mean Time. The Encyclopedia Britannica still says that he was probably the most intelligent person living at his time. And was involved in the politics and running of multiple kingdoms in Europe, and was one of the most influential figures of his time. Also created what is generally considered now to be the most potent system of magic ever revealed. So it kind of goes hand in hand. Your intelligent intellectuals through the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, because you can go through more, Roger Bacon, Francis Bacon, Tycho Brahe, just about all of them were involved in some kind of magical pursuit. Because during the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, that was just part of your education. You were generally educated by the church. The people who were the surviving magicians were the church clerics. And so if you had a high enough level of education, you were going to be exposed to magical teachings also, and probably end up practicing them. And it made sense that they practiced them, because for these people who were so intelligent, their feeling was, okay, I can only go so far with science, because science only has certain tools available to it, especially back then. And so at some point, you've just got to go ahead and just ask God and have God tell you how things work. And that was a lot of why these people got into magic. It was just another step along their scientific process. But just because lots of people believe in it and a lot of smart people believed in it doesn't necessarily mean it's rational. I mean, a lot of people voted for George W. Bush, and a lot of people voted for communist America. I know I'm the only person here that has those political views. It's okay. Just because it's the majority doesn't make it right. So you really have to get down to whether or not there's a rational consistency in looking at magic. And I think there really is. Now, you go through how does magic work? And it's become popular now to address it in terms of models of magic because of the advent of chaos magic back in the 70s and 80s. And I think it's the whole models of magic idea is neat in the sense of like analyzing and breaking down parts of magical theory, but the whole idea that the chaos magicians use of, well, today I'm going to believe this, and tomorrow I'm going to believe that, because I'm going to have an entirely pragmatic set of belief systems and not try to understand what reality is at all, is kind of ridiculous. And the way that I tend to approach things is to look at things in kind of a meta model, which I think most people who've been to classes that I've taught over a period of time probably have picked up on that, that my view is the best way to approach understanding how magic works is to combine the various different popular views on magic, and that it all comes down to essentially the energy model of the idea that the universe has an underlying energy that all of your other particles and everything are made from, and then everything else that we experience is made from all of those different particles, sort of extending various elements of scientific theory to a more base level. What? Yes, luminous beings are we. The most important part is to recognize that there is an underlying objective reality which we are observing subjectively. That was essentially one of the key components of early Greek philosophy, that the way in which we're able to interact with the world is because there is an objective truth. There is something that's there that's real beyond our desire to try and decide how things are and how things work. And we all experience it individually because of all of the different experiences we have leading up to it, because of the different ways in which our senses work. And so our experience of this objective reality will be different. But that doesn't take away its objectivity or its consistency. And so from there you get kind of a process of magic where you are changing your viewpoint on that objectivity. And so you begin to get kind of the Dion Fortune style magic, of magic being the art of changing consciousness at will. Where you're saying, okay, I'm understanding things this way, but now I'm going to shift how it is that I experience the world and how it is I view things, and I'm going to experience this objectivity this way. And my difference in that experience of the objectivity is the magical change that's going to change how things are in my life. And that's an important element to some forms of magic. Initiatic magic is all based on that process of moving yourself through and changing the way in which you perceive the world and therefore how you interact with the world and changing your experience through that. And I would say that's a pretty rational process. I mean, if you go to therapy, that's what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
If you just wake up in the morning and you're like, you know, I'm too argumentative, I'm going to be nicer today, then it's the same thing. The other element of it, though, that goes further is understanding the objective reality and how it works, and working within the bounds of that objective reality in order to change the way in which you're butting up against reality into something that's more amenable and more suitable to you. So there's a wall there. And if I walk into that wall, I'm going to feel a wall there. And it doesn't matter how much I try to change my consciousness or change my awareness of it, there's still going to be a wall there. Unless I learn to align all of my electrons perfectly so that they just pass by the electrons of the wall and then I can walk through it.
Or you could just walk
yes.
through
the yes.
Or use a big hammer.
Which would be good. Walking through the doorway is changing your perception. You move where you are and change your subjective view on the experience. So there's the wall is still there, but you've moved yourself, and so you're at a perspective where, oh, you can see the door and walk through the door. More practical magic is, well, it is more practical to just walk through the door. More of the idea of magic in the sense of understanding the objective nature of things so that you can work within that objective nature and change it is saying, okay, there's a wall here, and I don't like the wall being here, so I'm going to get a hammer and take the wall down. You recognize that there are certain structures in place, and there are certain ways you can interact with those structures, and that causes the structures to change in given ways. I think Jewish mysticism has a really great structure for addressing that, through the Kabbalah, in which the idea is that the tree of life represents the body of God. The body of God is the map of the manifestation of the universe. And so if you take these things that are in your physical experience and you move them into given alignments with one another, you're rerouting the body of God based on the way in which the things correspond. So you're changing the way in which the objective reality is working so that the objective reality itself changes, and then your experience of it changes as a result. And that's what you get into with magic, and that's where you have to look at whether or not what you're saying is consistent. But I would say if you're taking a view where there's an underlying energy to the universe, and you are united with that energy in your substance by being made from the same stuff that that energy is made from, and if that energy essentially comes down to the universal unity of the consciousness of God and everything that is in creation, then recognizing your sameness with that, recognizing your connection to that, you are able to interact with it. And through interacting with it, you're able to change the way that it flows and moves and works. And if manifestations are based on the way in which that energy is flowing and moving and working, the way in which it's vibrating or coalescing together in different ways, then it makes complete and total sense that you would be able to do magic. If I push Dustin, then that's just the energy that makes up the atoms of my body interacting with the energy that makes up the atoms of his body in order to move it. And the energy that my brain moves around telling that other energy that is my body to move around and push him. Magic is the same thing, just on a much more fundamental level. And that's something that you don't get in studying historical magic. That's like the thing that has kind of developed out of magic meeting up with contemporary science and magic moving into the modern age. And it's an important thing in developing magic and moving it further, is understanding how it works. And it's basically the same problem, though, that we experience with the rest of modernity, is that we find out, like, oh, well, this seems to work this way, this seems to work that way. I can do things this way. I don't have to think about any other underlying meanings or underlying purposes behind these things. Chemists like to smash atoms together in order to create transmutations. But their transmutations fall apart because they're just violently smashing atoms together without understanding how elements were created in the first place. Alchemists like to let things change over time and have God interact with the changes and their soul interact with the changes so that they can create something that is stable and well put together and betters what it is that they started with. One of those two is very not modern because it's slow and wants you to be reflective. The other one doesn't work. But because your fake atoms fall apart. But you see, a lot of your modern alchemical writers are also scientists. And their big criticism of contemporary science is that they've forgotten that sometimes it's better to take things slowly and better to look at some of the other underlying factors in a thing and explore how that plays into doing what it is you're trying to accomplish. It's the same thing in medical science where we say, okay, we have a series of symptoms. We're going to give you a bunch of pills that treat these symptoms, but we're not going to look at what the underlying cause of your symptoms is because that's too difficult to fix. We'll just make it so you don't feel them anymore. Whereas if you were to look at a hermetic or occult method of healing people, you would be looking at what the underlying metaphysical cause of the physical cause of the symptoms is and changing that underlying metaphysical cause so that you alleviate the physical cause and alleviate the symptoms. It's basically the difference between a traditional mindset and a contemporary mindset. And even in magic, we see that shift. If you look at really historical magical systems, and I mean, if you look far back, I mean, like I said earlier, magic is something that's ingrained in people's being. It's something that we see throughout society. And if you look back from the earliest points in history, we see things that seem like they're evidence of magic. A lot of people have looked at some of the things depicted in cave paintings and feel that it depicts some sort of shamanistic practices. That's a bit of speculation, but if we look not too much later after that, we'll see votives and curse tablets and spell inscriptions and things like that from very early historic man. And we see that across cultural boundaries. We don't need to get into all the details of all of those early systems, but the predecessor system to what most ceremonial magicians kind of do today, we can see as early as Babylon and in a lot of the early Semitic and Near Eastern cultures, where they had practices based on the idea of calling upon angels and demons and having them do things. Now, their structure was a little bit different. A lot of the records that we have of very early magical practices related to angels and demons, similar to some of what we see in the Middle Ages and Renaissance, is based on spirits of the planets, that these planetary forces were ruling divine forces, and that each one had an angel attached to it. Well, that's pretty familiar to most people who've studied medieval or Renaissance magic. But the difference is that these planets also had a demon attached to them, and that there was an interaction between the angel and the demon. The angel was called upon in order to call upon the demon, and the demon was then forced by the angel to do whatever it was that the magician said to do. Now, there is like one medieval magical text that uses that structure, but most people wouldn't be familiar with that. But that was sort of the very early magical system. And on the surface, it just looks like a structure for getting things done. You call up somebody's boss and you say, hey, I want you to have your guy go do this for me. It's just like what you would do now. Like if you wanted to get something done, you go to the person who's in charge or the person who's going to do it. You go to McDonald's, you don't like the way that they package up your food, so you call the manager and you tell the manager to make them do it right. On a bit of a more intrinsic level, though, when you look at this, you're looking at the way higher and lower forces interact, and you're looking at the way in which balance and the ability to command things interact. The planet exists as this divine force because it has this higher octave and it has this lower octave in balance with each other. And the lower octave is closer to the earthly experience than the higher octave is. So the higher octave can't just come in and make all these changes directly in the sphere of human experience. It has to go through the lower octave. And the lower octave can't command itself because it's too tied to all of these earthly elements, so it has to be commanded by the higher octave. So the point of the magician at that point is to balance and direct the interaction of these higher and lower forces. And that's something that very early on is lost in the way in which magic is structured. The idea that the magician isn't simply coming in there and because of his connection with God and because of being human and being important on the hierarchy, he's able to call upon demons and call upon angels and make them do things. That's where magic goes. It drops this whole idea that the magician is able to do these things, interact with these spirits, because he's the central force that's able to balance them and make them go out and do these things. So if you get into the advent of Judaism and Christianity, you still have this whole working with angels and demons, but like I said, it's based on the idea that man is special because God made man in his image and brought dirt to life by breathing into it. And I mean this the fun part about that piece of Genesis is that it's the exact same thing that Gnostics and Thelemites say when we talk about like that man is just a piece of God that's broken off and moved in a given way. God is spirit, and in most ancient languages, spirit and breath are the same thing. And so God takes a piece of his spirit and puts it into some clay to make the clay move around and do things. But that becomes the only reason why man is able to control demons and angels at that point. But we start to get into more interesting things about how he's controlling the demons and angels. If you look at a lot of the medieval and Renaissance texts, the spirits can go through, they can accomplish wonders, they can give people things, they can show you where to find treasure, they can raise armies for you, they can topple nations, all the different things that a court magician would need to do back in the Middle Ages or the Renaissance, like in order to make their king happy. But the other thing that they do much more consistently is teach you things. And there are people who basically compare what the spirits do in Renaissance and medieval texts to going to a liberal arts college. because if you run through what they'll do, they'll teach you about politics, they'll teach you about all the sciences that existed in the day, they'll teach you history, they'll teach you about art. Visago even teaches you how to behave in a courtly setting. And it's pretty much everything is covered by these spirits. And that goes back to why people engage in these practices, is because from the spirits they could get knowledge that went beyond what they could do in their own scientific research at the time because of their limited tools. If you look at some of the apocryphal Jewish texts, particularly the Enoch books, you see a lot of that where it's like you go up into the heavens, you talk with the angels, and the angels explain to you how the universe works and how everything moves around in the universe. And because you get that understanding from them, you're able to take that knowledge back and go through and do things and accomplish things in the world. And the important part of that is not simply that people did magic in order to get knowledge, but that knowledge and magic were based on the idea of connecting with the divine. When they wanted to get this knowledge, they had to rise up into the heavens and have the angels show them. Or they had to call the angels down to earth and have the angels tell them, or call the demons up from hell and have the demons tell them. And they were able to do this because of their connection with divinity and because they were praying to God and making that connection even stronger. When you take that a step further, you start to get to the point where not only are they using divinity to get this knowledge, but they're recognizing that by expanding their knowledge of the way in which the universe works, that they're coming closer to a unity with God at that point. And not only are they becoming better as magicians, but they're becoming more complete, pious people, because now they understand how God creates all of his wonders in the universe, and they can have more awe and experience about it. There was a scientist, I think it was Feynman, and Carrie would probably know if it was him or not, who was asked once if understanding all this stuff about science and the way the universe works makes the experience of simple things less pleasurable. And he responded that by understanding how everything works, the experience of simple things becomes so much better. That when he smells a rose, he gets to think about all of the different chemical interactions and physical processes that are going on in his sensory experience of the rose, and it becomes a much more complex, deeper experience through that. And that's basically the same thing that you get with these magicians who are going out and saying, okay, I want to understand all of how God makes the universe work, is that every experience they have, they can now see the fingerprint of God on that experience. They can see, well, I know that this is how the angels go and do this for God, and this is what I'm seeing, so the angels are going and doing all of this. So again, it becomes about the obtainment of kind of a spiritual awareness or a more greater closeness to the divine in doing all of these magical pursuits that you see in these grimoire books where it looks like, hey, I just want to go get treasure. And it's like, okay, well, yeah, you're going to get treasure, but then you're going to use that treasure and go find God with your treasure. If you look a little bit later after the grimoire period into the development of the Kabbalah, you've got a lot of influence on the Kabbalah from these traditional sources. But one of the big focuses of it was that you're understanding the interrelation of the soul, the world, and God. So there, it's not even implied there anymore. It's just straight up that the whole thing that you're studying in this mysticism is how to get back to being connected with God, and that you're connected with God because you and the universe and God all share the same blueprint, basically. And that when the Kabbalists would do their magical practices and work their wonders, like we said earlier, it was all about looking at the map of the Tree of Life, looking at the way in which God is structured, and saying, okay, these things that I'm experiencing in the universe relate to this part of God, and so I can put these things together, and I can make this change. But in making this change, not only am I getting what I want, but I'm understanding the universe better, I'm understanding myself better, I'm understanding God better. And their whole system was about making changes in order to correct the failures in the universe. That because man sinned and was expelled from Eden, things were not right with God, they weren't right with the universe, they weren't right with man. And so by living the laws of the Torah, they were able to correct those structures that had failed in the creation of the universe and bring everything back into a harmonious state. The whole point was to regain Eden for all of mankind. So basically reconnecting Malchut, or the world, into Yesod, or the foundation. So the very bottom of the tree back to the dangly bit below the bottom of the tree, putting them back. It is actually, they do use sexual imagery for this, that Malchut is sort of the universal vagina, and Yesod is God's phallus, and you put them back together and everyone's happy. Yes. And if you look again at some of the apocryphal texts that predated the Kabbalah and look at the concept of Eden. Okay, you look at the Bible, you've got Eden, it's like, okay, there's this garden, and you've got these two magic trees in it, and there's all these animals, and there's a naked man and a naked woman running around, and it's paradise, and it's kind of nice. And God comes and visits them and talks to them sometimes. If you look at the apocryphal texts, Eden has at the center of it the Tree of Life, and it's this huge, great, overarching tree that canopies over everything. And it glistens with light and fire. And everything there glistens with light and fire, because the fire and light are the presence of the divine. And everything that's described in Eden is basically describing that it's basically a place that's pretty much just God being there and shining about and being all happy and pleasant, so that you can be there and you're nestled within the bosom of God, essentially, in this place that you're living. And so that's what they were trying to return to with the Kabbalah, is this state of having the entire universe subsumed up into the fires of the divine, so that everything was taken into that place of God. And if you look at the later Lurianic Kabbalah, it gets even more extreme, where the whole use is not only are they saying, okay, well, the reason that we engage in the Torah is that that helps us fix the universe so we can come back to God, but they would actually go out and look for instances that had the right magical and metaphysical elements to them, so that they could use specific things described within the Torah that they were supposed to do, so that they could free the trapped sparks of God that were down in the hells beneath the earth. And in doing so, bring about the Messianic Age, so that God could come and be present with man once more like it was in Eden. And then when you move past sort of the developments of the Kabbalah, and actually probably a little bit before Luria, you have the development of the Enochian system. And this system pretty much explains the idea more perfectly than any of the other systems. You have D going and getting knowledge from the angels, and the knowledge that the angels give him is how to get more and better knowledge from more and better angels. Yes.
He was the bright one, but didn't kind of need Kelly to be like,
yes,
spark to him, because,
right, because
Kelly actually had better sense with being able to see him into the,
right,
the psychic sense was stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, D was not a competent scryer, and he needed someone to be able to look into the crystal and see what the angels were telling him. And in the Enochian system, it goes into a much more sort of complex relationship between the angelic and the demonic forces. Even though D didn't want anyone working with the demonic forces, it still explained how they fall under the angelic forces and how the forces relate to each other. And basically the system gets down to the point where every manifestation in the universe is basically a catalogable spiritual force. And that as you combine these forces together, you get other manifestations of catalogable spiritual forces. And you're able to explore the entirety of the universe by analyzing it in this manner. And in taking that further, the angels tell him how not only can you understand, like, well, this is the angel for this, this is the angel for that, this is how all these angels work together through these interactions, but the angels show him how, okay, well, you can call the angels and they can come talk to you, but you can also go up into the heavens and see what things are like there and just talk to the angels there and see how everything works through all these heavenly levels. And so the angels give him the names of all the heavens and the call to use in order to open them up so that he can have visions and experience them, or anyone using a system can do so. And D was pretty expressed about the reason that he was doing this was because there just wasn't enough science for him. He was too smart. Like, he needed some way to get even deeper knowledge. If you look at the science and health of the earth, which is the section of D's work that deals with the 91 parts of the earth, it basically divides up the earth into 91 sections ruled over by different angels. And contained within it is the idea that if you were to call upon each of these 91 angels and understand everything that they could teach you, because they basically rule over all of these 91 nations, which represent all different types of knowledge and experience within the earth, that you would then coalesce all knowledge together and be able to topple all the world's governments and bring about the apocalypse.
Right. Dr. John, the Elizabethan in 1865, we've got 1865 thereabouts.
Yeah.
That'd be great. Was he...
Bless you.
This is something in the back of my mind. Christopher Marlowe writes Dr. Faustus about the same
yeah.
time. Was he
yeah.
thinking
he,
of
he was
D?
Making fun of D and Dr.
Yeah,
Faustus.
That's what I'm saying,
because
that's a
yeah.
discussion.
The
great,
like
the
great
issue.
The Goethe Faust book was about the German figure of Faust. The Marlowe Faust play was making fun of John D.
Okay.
And so, but basically, so you've got this idea where it's like, okay, you pull together all of this knowledge and understand everything about how the world manifests and the experience on the earth, and you can bring about the apocalypse. And people argue back and forth about whether or not this is the point of the Enochian system. Like, some people are like, yeah, D was really apocalyptic, and he wanted the Armageddon to happen, and that's why he revealed this system, and someday somebody's going to do it, and it's going to be awful. And, you know, the people are like, no, those people who think that are crazy. That has nothing to do with the Enochian system. It's just horrible. And the thing that both sides are missing on that is that D straight up says this in his work. This is what it's for. But apocalypse just means vision. It's just the ripping away all the things that hide the veils of God, and you're able to see how the universe works. And so if you have all of the knowledge of everything compressed into yourself, you've basically consumed the tree of knowledge, and that can either take you away from God or it can take you completely back into God, because you have now coalesced everything in existence into yourself, which is what God is. And if you do that correctly, that's the same as the experience of crossing the abyss and moving yourself into the point where you've obliterated the divisions between yourself and God, and you understand the way in which the universe works. So again, the point of kind of the crowning achievement in Western ceremonial magical development is to bring yourself back to this, like, complete and total relationship with the divine, and complete yourself in that fashion. So then several hundred years pass, and we've got Rosicrucianism and Masonry and all of these things that are kind of doing some magic, but the world's in turmoil. No one knows how much they want to focus on magic right now. And then you get to the Victorian era, where people are like, we have money, and we can relax and be leisurely. Yes.
As I say, it comes back thinking about that sequence that's happening there. So you also have a period in European world history known as the Black Death,
mm-hmm.
where substantial numbers, in fact, this imagery hops back to that,
mm-hmm.
where the grimoires link back to the Black Death, where whole villages are wiped out.
Yes.
It's basically like a long-standing cultural, social psychological upheaval in the 1940s. In creating a lot of questions like, you know, what is it really, what does life really mean when you know, somebody that I see the next, I saw him this morning, the next day, you know, the door shut.
Yeah.
And then you have the ones that we think of, when we see that, we think of the brief period of the plague in England from about 1660 to 1665.
Mm-hmm.
Where you actually have the administration of quarantine, so you think of the veterans that you don't keep them inside.
Mm-hmm.
Like this.
So that's
social thing. Theory and play bringing so much up and stuff. When that happened, all sorts of stuff popped up.
Yeah.
As a means of things going into, not just the usual things that everybody traditional historical locally asked. Again, all the military misadventures, the Hundred Years' War being fitting by the time between France and England.
Mm-hmm.
So,
once we get past all the things that would distract people from doing magic, we get to the Golden Dawn. And there were a lot of other groups predating the Golden Dawn around that time, but they're not important. They're not cool like the Golden Dawn. No, like, a lot of them are important just in the sense that they led to the Golden Dawn, honestly.
For example?
There was the German Golden Dawn organization, which had basically the same name, just in German. Societas Rosicruciana in Anglia, which was another English organization that a lot of the Golden Dawn leadership was basically the British Society of Rosicrucians or the English Society of Rosicrucians.
Okay.
And we'll talk about them a little bit in the class on the Path of the Rose Cross. Those are two of the main ones that led to the Golden Dawn, but you also have the Theosophists and the Spiritism movement. Yes, and the Society of Rosicrucianism in England was a Masonic organization. You had to be a Mason in order to join that. And so you had all these things that were kind of preserving a lot of the occult knowledge from these earlier magical systems and people kind of experimenting with it somewhat. And there's some question as to like how much they were actually trying to do it and how much they were trying to just say, like, oh, well, this is part of being high society, that I'm engaged in these alchemical and magical practices. But then with the Golden Dawn, it gets very clearly straight up that the whole idea is, okay, we're going to go and do this magic. And so they take all these pieces of the various magical systems and what they have left of them anyway, with the incomplete manuscripts and poor translations of things, and they put together a whole system where they basically take all the little bits and pieces that they see in magical texts and kind of create almost a compendium and then an education system where they try to make it all a systematic approach with all these pieces fitting together very neatly. And it was really a brilliant effort doing that and kind of revolutionized the way in which people learned and did magic. And people were able to start thinking about why magic worked and how magic worked and a lot of the things that people discuss and focus on now. And writing about magic and talking about magic and doing magic became a lot easier, not simply because it was now legal or legal shortly thereafter in most places, but also because they began the process of writing things in an approach where the point was for people to learn it and understand it, as opposed to writing it in a way in which the point was to obscure it or to simply catalog a few practices and things that you would need, but with the expectation that if you were deserving of doing this, you would be within the social system in which this was being done and have it passed along to you. And there was, to some degree, still this idea that you were supposed to be coming closer to the divine through your magical practice. But if you look at a lot of the stuff in the initial grades of the Golden Dawn, it's very piecemeal. Like you're learning, okay, these are the colors that go with the Tree of Life spheres. These are the Hebrew letters. These are a bunch of symbols that you can use. And it's all these parts, but not anything that you can actually do. Because their whole idea was that you learn all this stuff, like you go through your grammar school of magic, essentially, and then after you do that, you go into like your master's work and you begin actually doing the magic with all those pieces that you learned. And it's when you're doing that master work that you start focusing on the idea of coming into contact with the divine and changing yourself through alchemy in order to be more related to God. But they didn't really ever finish writing their second level of materials, so no one ever actually really did it. And there are a few, because they did have the Adeptus Minor ritual written, and Mathers had notes at the very least for the other rituals, but there were no materials written for the other rituals. So you had people who got the Adeptus Minor, so they got the first grade that was used in that second set of rituals, and a lot of them put together materials that were supposed to be deepening the materials that you learned in the first set. And they had as their stated purpose that you were working to become more than human, that you were trying to understand the Lord and the way in which God appears within you through your holy guardian angel and come into connection with that. But as the Golden Dawn fell apart and just left splinters behind, a lot of the contemporary Golden Dawn groups have sort of accepted the idea that when someone becomes an adept, it's basically just a title. It's they're being recognized for their work in the order and their leadership capabilities within the order. And so they're an adept because they can run a Golden Dawn temple, not necessarily because they actually have attained knowledge and conversation with their Holy Guardian Angel. And this has kind of become the accepted Golden Dawn culture. So it loses a lot of the initial purpose. And from that, we start getting other magical developments that also lose a lot of that initial purpose. You get chaos magic, where the whole point is just, let's do a lot of sorcery, and we'll play with dolls and draw symbols and dress like goths and read Alice in Wonderland and decide that we can structure a magical system based on the universe of Alice in Wonderland because nothing is real and we can do whatever we want.
And worship the Animaniacs.
Yes. And so it completely drops everything. All of the great and awesome parts of historical magic are pretty much lost. The entirety of the idea that you become a better magician because you gain greater understanding of the universe, and in gaining greater understanding of the universe, greater understanding of yourself, and therefore the divine, because all three are linked together as one continual sameness, it becomes irrelevant at that point, at least in the minds of the people doing it, because it's like, oh, well, if I can take a word and scramble it into a symbol and then choke myself out while masturbating, maybe something will happen. That's all they care about.
Just keep in mind, you say that at the beginning of the Golden Dawn, somebody in the Golden Dawn, the first thing they're learning is something. These colors go with this. I'll be sure here's the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, all kinds of information. That's kind of along the lines of what an apprentice gets today. The apprentice doesn't go anywhere near the wilderness, like, okay, you know, first thing I want you to do is I want you to show me what it all, show me what it is. Okay, you got all those things, that's good. All right. It's like, well, what am I going to do anything? Well, first, you know, you got to know what the tools are, where they go first. Then you go from the apprentice to the craftsman stage.
Mm-hmm.
And you're good to go, and you go through what you're doing today, and then finally it's like, okay, we're on the more complex side.
Mm-hmm.
People that are in Golden Dawn, they're largely up in the, they were upper middle class to upper
mm-hmm.
class, were they not?
Yes.
So they only knew, it's interesting, they only kind of inferentially or occasionally knew folks that were actually in the blue collar craft type of working
mm-hmm.
to do these sort of things. So kind of like,
yeah.
So dilettantishly looking, but being very thorough and precise.
Yeah. And it's a good way of educating people. You just have to have the step after they get the education. Like, Dustin is one of my fencing students, and how many weeks was it before you were allowed to actually fence anyone?
Like, 2 or 3.
Probably more than that. It was like 2 or 3 weeks of you doing footwork before you even, like, used a blade.
Oh.
So I would say you probably spent... You got to do it a little faster than most of your other, like, teammates, but most of them spent probably a month and a half of just learning basic movements before they were able to actually do anything with them. I think Christine had a question too.
Well, I just want to follow up on that.
not actually a fan of that much.
Yes.
On the other hand, I can appreciate the perspective that some chaos magicians have, which is that essentially all symbols and all concepts really are getting down to the psychological states behind them, and that what you're working on is theoretically the psychological state and not the external manifestation of the organizational system. Therefore, pick whatever you want, do whatever you want, only try to focus the head down. Right? It gives a little bit of credit.
No, I definitely agree. My mentor was one of the like founding people of Autonomatrix, and so I got a lot of chaos magic stuff in my magical education. But I think all of that work, like the techniques are good, and the approach to breaking everything down into the basic components and understanding the components is good. I think that they just can't ever move beyond the step of being simple sorcerers, because they don't have anything else beyond that. And I think that's where the system is a good example of modernity meeting magic.
Yeah, I think the ones that work off of the quantum mechanics principles can get some flex out of
that. Yeah.
If they actually try and learn them.
Yes. Like, and really learn them instead of collecting imaginary moon rocks. Yeah, something else.
I think the other side of that, in terms of the structure, also is that there are those that consider it like Hindus consider word to give, to impart information or knowledge to the student that hasn't reached that level that they need to be at is akin to giving a knife to a monkey.
Yeah. They won't have the control in order to do this. And so, my bashing of chaos magic aside, and I don't even know what that note means. I would say the overarching point that magic historically had up until the modern era was to know and understand the self and the universe, and than to use this to correct things in the universe, to make things more the way that it seemed like they should be. Now, the way in which people interpreted correcting things was not necessarily always guided by higher principles. Sometimes it was guided by the idea that my kingdom is better than the other kingdoms, and we should use our magic in order to help our king defeat the other kingdoms, which could be guided by higher principles. Exactly. But there was still this idea that the magician was seeking after knowledge, and that the magician was trying to come to the greater truth and understand that greater truth. And that still does exist in modern magic to some point. Like we said, the motto of the Golden Dawn was to become more than human. It was still focusing on that point. If you look at the law of Thelema, do what thou wilt shall be the whole law, love is the law, love under will. That is the perfect encapsulation of that idea, that you are coming to understand what your true nature is, and since your true nature is an echo of the nature of God in the universe, then you're understanding the nature of God in the universe in doing so, and living your true nature, you're living in accordance with the overall natural order of things, and therefore helping others do so as well. And it's just that the method sometimes falls short. When people learn magic primarily by cobbling together knowledge out of different books that are focused on giving people kind of a beginner's education on things and making it sound friendly and happy and easy, and not addressing philosophical components or religious or theological components, and not addressing what risks or dangers are there, because they don't want people to be scared or think that they have to actually think about what they're doing, then it kind of becomes about not having a purpose. It kind of becomes about, well, my boss was mean to me, so I'm going to chant until I feel better. Or, yes, that's really the best way of putting it. It all just becomes a superstition at that point, because it's not analyzed anymore. It's just the same thing as saying, I'm going to go do ceremonial magic because I like ceremonies, or because it makes me feel better, it gives me catharsis. Magic was My feeling on that has always been that it works. You can do magic for the point of catharsis. You can also go see a doctor, and or go talk to one of your friends in order to feel better. That going out and getting a bunch of robes and candles and setting up altars and things like that is infinitely more complicated than some of the other things that you could do in order to feel better about what's bothering you. That's true, especially if you're using a really humanistic model where the process is like the center of everything. But I mean, I will give you, there is definitely a purpose to that. It's the utility of that process doesn't negate the utility of the actual point of magic.
It's funny, it almost sounds like you're saying it's a big magic meaning that whether or not the supernatural component exists.
No, I'm hardcore on the external side. Like, I will beat you up over it. My feeling and experience.
Keep in mind also, if you've ever read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and they talk about the visions of the Bardo being all projections of the mind, and yet they're both external and they're internal at the same time.
Well, that's like they're claiming now that they've been able to reproduce the light you see when you're dying in certain deoxygen states. They're able to reproduce this when you hit certain parts of the brain, it imitates the same process that you see in the experience. So there's not even using the DMT, there's different drugs that they're claiming to find a physical mechanism behind it. It's just weird because I don't understand personally how you feel it.
Yeah.
But there is this whole school of magic which claims you can't reach. And they still bring your house down.
Yeah. my experience of it is that you can do magic with the all in your head model.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different from doing magic with the external model. That there are things that you can do based on the capabilities of a human that are a bit outside of what people on average think of the capabilities of a human. And so if you are seriously working some magical ritual where you're imagining that you've externalized a piece of yourself as some spirit that's going to go do things for you, but it's just a piece of yourself that you're extending, then on a limited sense, it can go out and do things for you. And it will be very different from what you can have happen if you call an actual demon or angel and have it go do things for you.
Doesn't the notion of man as a microcosm and macrocosm kind of reconcile those two? Because if you understand more the fractal of the entire universe contained within man itself, then an internal change would very much so correspond to an external. So you
yes.
can take either side
yep.
of the argument.
And there,
so you're back to an external representation of God.
Yeah.
So you don't have to assume there's
God. Yeah. There's lots of magical work you can do based on that. Witchcraft is largely based on creating internal changes in order to create external changes, based on the connection between man and the nature, or man and the universe. And even to go so far as to say, like, okay, this god or this angel or this demon has an external existence, but because you and the universe are the same, it exists within you and you exist within it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that interaction. There's a truth to that also. I think most people who argue in favor of the it's all in your head model, a lot of them will go back to that as a justification. But when you actually look at their arguments, they're never actually talking about that. They are talking about going through psychological processes in order to use different psychological components of yourself and reintegrate them or separate them out and break them down and change the way in which you experience things. If it were all the sort of the what the Kabbalion talks about, that all is mind, and they were looking at that state that everything in the universe is all a mental expression, and you are simply a thought within that mental expression, and that you can kind of dissolve your separation into the point where the other mental expressions are a part of the same mental expression that you're part of, then yes, it is all in the greater head of God, essentially, at that point. But if it's just, well, I'm going to think about this thing, and I know I felt bad about something the other day, so I'm going to take that bad feeling, and I'm going to name that bad feeling this demon, and I'm going to call that bad feeling out for myself and mitigate the bad feeling that way. Or I'm going to apply that bad feeling to this other thing that's going on in my life through this ritual process. It's a very different magical process. It's a workable one. It's just one that's different and operates in a different fashion. And I personally have experienced that it has a different level of efficacy. I would say you can't be one and be a really awesome, successful, kick-ass one. But there are people who would disagree with me. So, to bring it back in, the point of modern magic is really the same as the point of classical magic. And if you even look at the Golden Dawn system, or some things that are hinted at in the AA system, once you get to that level of adepthood, you start doing classical magic anyway. With the Golden Dawn system, all of that was preparing you to be able to do grimoire magic and to do classical alchemy. And the few bits and pieces that they wrote about what you do after you become an adept is all stuff that's about consecrating talismans using angels, calling upon angels and spirits, and making alchemical changes with physical chemicals.
It makes sense that you would have to first start out with a number of the bases, because one of the sections that you had to do in Golden Dawn, you actually had to design your own tarot, did you know?
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the requirements.
Yeah. So the idea with their system is that you fully integrated all of the different elements of magical practice to the point where you don't have to stop and think about them and get confused about them when you're doing something where it could be dangerous for you to be stopping and thinking and getting confused. That it's all ingrained in you to the point where you see some series of symbols and you know, okay, this is what that series of symbols is. This is part of my being. I can now operate based on this symbol language. But that you're doing that so that you can reach the point where you're able to do the traditional magic that requires you to have those skills, and where you're able to use that to move yourself further and further along the lines of adepthood and mastery towards understanding the cosmos and the divine. So with that... Oh, okay.
Are you then saying that if you take the Golden Dawn route of magical development, that's the same... pretty much the same route as classical magical development?
It takes
you're
you to the same end if you do
that
it correctly.
The goal is the same.
Yeah, but the method is different. It's like a like going from an apprentice system to a university system almost, where classically you would be taught by another magician or you'd be taught by a priest and going through like all of these things where you're learning all of the disciplines that go into what you're going to do. But you have someone handing it to you, whereas there it's like, okay, we have a set curriculum that you're going to follow and you'll be tested on. So it's a different method of instruction and a different way of kind of categorizing how the instruction is done, but it eventually takes you to the same end. And we're actually going to talk a little bit about that in the next class, but before we do the next class, I believe Carrie has lunch together.
Not quite.
Well, then, if you want.
Are you done? The issue is the soup, because the power's wonky. We don't have hot soup yet. We have lukewarm soup. But people can put it in the microwave, so
yeah.
If you're ready for that, then we can indeed have lunch.
Yes. Or if, then, at the very least, you can stretch your legs a little bit or ask more questions.
Going back to my question again, well, it seems as though you're saying that Golden Dawn took bits and pieces of magic that's been preserved in the Western literature, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and put it together to say, okay, here's a whole bunch of different bits of information and techniques, and here's how you can put some of them together, but you're not really going to be able to put all of it together until you reach a very high level, and the group itself's kind of splintered or imploded before it really got to that.
Pretty much.
Are you saying that Well, in ancient Greece, in ancient Rome, in North Africa, the roots of Western civilization, that there was something pretty much like Golden Dawn at that time. Or was it really, there wasn't much like Golden Dawn at that time, there were just little bits and pieces?
Well, it would, I would say there wasn't something that was so systematic as to trying to cover all of magic in one system, but you would have some things that would have a very formal education system, like in a lot of the mystery traditions, becoming a priest or priestess of those particular mystery traditions, there was a lot of training that you'd have to undergo in order to have that. It wasn't that you simply would walk in and say, I want to be this. In the Etruscan and Roman systems, what we still know of their augury system, for the haruspexes, there was a very systematic, formal training that they had to go through. The records that we have of the Druids, they had very formal, rigid training requirements in their systems as well. But they, all of those systems, they were related to particular things and particular expressions. It wasn't trying to systematize all magic. And so you'd have people who were involved in various mystery traditions sometimes, as opposed to just being involved in one. Then you'd have other systems where it was much more sort of down to earth, just like our folk magic systems are. Like, I guess if you went to Thessaly, learning to cut someone's heart out and use that to curse people probably didn't involve a whole lot of education. or even in Virgil's Bucolics, where he talks about like the happy country magical practices of people there.
Everyone just wants to talk.
It's just they would go out, they would learn all the herbs, they would learn the natural symbols, and a lot of that was stuff that you would, for a large part, just learned growing up. There were a lot of little magical things that I learned growing up before I started studying magic, but that wouldn't be the types of things the Golden Dawn would systematize. And when I started learning traditional witchcraft, like the first requirement I had there was to go out and sit in the woods and watch. And so, like, you have a lot of things like that where it's like you, depending on, it depends on the system that you're dealing with. So I would say early on, your training methods would depend on the area you were in, the type of magic you were doing, and who was teaching it to you. But you would still have some formal, some systems that have more formal things. There's all the legends of the black schools of Europe, like particularly in Toledo, where like you would have hidden universities where they taught magic. If you look at the myths of Christian Rosenkreutz and the founding of the Rosicrucians, he went through a lot of those before he eventually went to the mythical Demkar and was taught the true magic there. Same with Abraham the Jew in Sacred Magic of Abimael and the Mage. He catalogs all the different places he went to and all the different types of magicians that he encountered who taught him different methods of magic based on their own systems and their methods of teaching. And it wasn't until he found Abimelin that he felt that he learned the true magic. Curiously, even though he feels he learned the true magic from Abimelin, he gives the true magic to one of his sons, and then he alleges that there's another book he's written on the Kabbalah, which is given to his other son. So even he acknowledges different methods of magic and different methods of magical training, not only in his own journey, but in how he was passing things on to his children. So the Golden Dawn essentially tried to take all of those different things and catalog them and categorize them so that you pretty much just had a filing system, basically, where you could pull out what you needed from the filing system and say, okay, well, these things all go together, so I'm going to use this, and I'm going to juxtapose them with these other things in order to get this effect.
So would you say
the Golden Dawn was the
first official
Sinai tradition?
Before it was, you learned it in school.
Haitian voodoo.
Mm-hmm.
Might.
Golden Dawn,
yeah.
Everywhere, organized.
I would say they would be the... Maybe there's even formality there. I would say they're the first Western syncretic... the first industrial nation syncretic system. Because you have the Afro-Caribbean systems combined masonry, Catholicism, Western magic, and African traditions, Indo-Socratic system, and they would have been about 150, 200 years earlier. Yeah, I would say probably only the Budan system would have been similarly organized. Like, I don't think Candomblé or Santeria. No, Santeria is still pretty... It is still linear. I was just thinking in terms of that they have structures that you have to go through before you could do one thing and then the next thing. But yeah, it is still all based on passing from... That is a lot of stuff.
Yes, it is. You should ship this, but don't forget, a lot of this will be tomorrow.
Yes.
Are you done answering questions? I can tell you what was actually here.
Okay, yeah. Unless anyone has more questions on that part or anything we've covered so far today, Carrie will go through the food, and while you're eating, you can ask me questions if you want to. So, Carrie, you can just go through the food.
We have garlic cheese bread and some kind of pumpkin seedy whole bread.